Hello, and welcome to the Hali Hewa podcast with your host, Abigail Kima. This podcast brings together key African players in the climate space while they share their experiences and their stories to ensure that we amplify the African climate voices. On set today, we have two amazing ladies, and I am honored to have them on set today. I will just read out their bios out. Elizabeth Wathuti is a renowned young climate activist from Kenya, whose passion for conservation and climate justice has been evident over the years. She's the founder of Green Generation Initiative, a Kenyan-based organization that is creating a generation of environmentally conscious individuals by educating and empowering children and communities to love nature through various programs, which you'll be elaborating more on this episode. Our second guest, Wanjira Mathai, is the Vice President and Regional Director for Africa at the World Resource Institute, previously served as Senior Partnership Advisor, Strategy and Advocacy for WPower, Partnership of Women's Entrepreneurship in Renewables, and WRI's Senior Advisor to the Global Restoration Initiative. She's the current chairperson of Wangari Maathai Foundation and the former chairperson of the Green Belt Movement in Kenya. Welcome, Liz and Wanjira. It is an honor to have you on set today.
Thank you.
So while I was thinking about this conversation, I wanted to draw the connection between the three of us. So a funny story is I met Liz in Kenyatta University, and I was a first year. I was just walking in the streets of KU, and she approached me telling me about the Kenyatta University Environmental Club. And being a first year, of course, you don't really know where to go or what to do. But then she informed me that there was a meeting every Tuesday, and I showed up and I became a leader, and the rest is history. And looking at you now, I remember at some point when you were applying for the Wangari Maathai Foundation Scholarship Award, I don't think you remember, your laptop crashed just when you were pressing send to submit the application. And we rushed to Kenyatta Market to take out the hard disk and came back to submit the application. And that is when GGI was born. And I believe this is also a reflection of the amount of work, or rather the good work, that Wanjira has been doing to carry through the late Professor Wangari Maathai's legacy. So before I go on and on about where this all began, I'd like to invite Wanjira to introduce yourself, let us know who you are and the amazing work that you do.
Well, thank you. First of all, thanks for having me and Liz on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, thank you for having Liz and me on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And just also, what a lovely story you tell about Liz, because I know I was on the jury of that prize.
Mm-hmm.
And I know just how impressive she was. So the thought that we could have missed her that is sort of special, that little story.
Yeah.
So you mentioned in the bio, I'm the Vice President Regional Director for Africa at WRI, and what that means is I lead the strategy work, the development of all of our work in Africa, especially around nature-based solutions, which is forests, food, water,
mm-hmm.
And how those interact with people. There's always the idea that what does it mean for the livelihoods and lives of people and the quality of life of people. We also work a lot on cities. We see cities as landscapes, and these are essentially the landscapes on which most people in Africa live and will live. Most of the cities on our continent will double in size in the next 30 years, and so we have to plan for that. And how we move around those cities, how we manage our water in those cities is part of our work. And then the third work pillar of our work is focused on the enabling environment, and the idea that all of this only happens in an environment where the political economy is conducive, where you engage quite effectively with the political economy, where people understand their responsibilities and roles with respect to that, but also looking at what holds us back, what are the policies that are holding us back, both locally, regionally, and globally, and working, advocating, or just working actively to create the enabling environment.
Thank you so much for that. On to you, Liz. Tell us about yourself.
Thank you for having us, and I'm really honored as well to be here with Wanjira, and the story that you've shared just reminds me how I was really excited to meet her, because one of the things I always wanted for me was to meet Wangari Maathai so much. I always tell everyone that. But to see the fact that her daughter is a mentor to me has been really a great honor. And the fact that she has put so much to making sure that young people feel engaged and that they can be able to navigate spaces also where decisions are being made. And for me, my work has been through focusing on environmental issues and climate justice, but most importantly, trying to bring the link between what we do here in Kenya on the ground and in the grassroots, and also how that now feeds into the international community. Because as much as we are trying to do all this work on the ground, even the work that you mentioned with the children, it's not going to be enough also if not much is being done by the international community. So I try to bring that bridge between how we make sure that these voices are being heard up there and out there. And also, I work at the Wangari Maathai Foundation as the head of campaigns. And one of the really most exciting campaigns just recently is the African Climate Activist Hub. I think it's going to be the Wangari Maathai Africa Climate Activist Hub, to just make sure that young people and young African activists feel engaged meaningfully and in a genuine way, because it has been something that has been lacking. And also another campaign that we recently did was Follow the Money campaign, to ensure that climate finance trickles down to the grassroots communities. So all this work is interlinked with what we're doing with communities on the ground, what we're doing with everyone around the country, Kenya, and then how we make sure that these stories, these voices, and this work feeds into the international community, because climate change is a global problem that everybody needs and has got a role to play to make sure that we are solving it.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, people don't realize how a powerhouse you are just sitting here with us, speaking so casually, yet you recently represented us at the World Economic Forum in Davos. I think you just got back. You probably have a jet lag. But I just want to know, what was your experience like being an African young activist, not just an African, but a young woman from Kenya, being in that space? I remember on our call, you told me how they were talking about cryptocurrencies and you were just wondering, where am I? So what was your experience like in general, just being in that space and also being in a very high level panel with people like John Kerry? What was that like?
First, it was my first time in Davos, first time at the World Economic Forum. I have been to similar events before, which was COP26. And so comparing it to COP26, it was definitely a very different platform for me, a different group of people, different audience, different feeling and environment around the people that were there. And being there for the first time, I didn't really know what to expect from everyone else, but really getting into there, I almost felt like I was in two parallel worlds, you know, universes where outside this is what people are saying, but inside there, it's a different conversation that you have to keep pushing about climate issues. But I think the fact that there was that platform to actually make sure that these people are not losing focus of the ongoing climate crisis, because I know there was a lot of conversations around the war in Ukraine and a lot of conversations around the economy. And trying to just feed into the climate conversations, into all this, and even trying to highlight the fact that, you know, the Ukraine war is still affecting us directly, you know, food insecurity, and the fact that not many people are even aware of this, and how it's also like links to what's happening in the African continent, was a bit strange. But really, the fact that the things that you hear in the inside are not in line with the rising inequalities and climate change impacts, I think that was what was different from being at WEF and at the COP. And of course, I think what's really important is to make sure that these forums remain relevant to these rising inequalities, so that we don't lose focus of the fact that also COP27 is coming up. And these same people, most of them were at COP26, they made commitments, they made pledges. And so I felt that we have been here before, we've had these things before, and you know, we've had these pledges, these promises before that have been made and not been kept. So how can we make these forums to be a bit different? And I think for me, that was the experience. But again, I would think that maybe in future, if the forum would be, you know, more inclusive and remain to be relevant in terms of the rising inequalities and climate change impacts, then we can feed all these things even as we move ahead with climate change conversations. But it needs to be really inclusive for everyone, because it's about the inequalities. And if it's not addressed in such forums, then it would be difficult for us to address it elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. I mean, I always think or say to myself that there is no economic development, there's no food security, there's no every good thing that we desire without a stable climate. And it is actually extremely important for sectors to incorporate climate change or put it at the center of development, especially when it comes to Africa, since we have an opportunity to start from somewhere through a very clear path that is clean and, you know, climate conscious. And while you were introducing yourself, you did mention something on the Youth Climate Activist Hub, and we have Wanjira here who's solely responsible for that with your support as well. So very many African organizations are not really doing that. They're not really necessarily focusing on young people who are actually the biggest population in Africa. So what is the motivation behind that? What is the vision? Because as young people, we are always craving for someone to hold our hand, because when you go to such big conferences like COP26, yes, you're in that space, but you're not necessarily engaged. It's like you just move around until you figure your way out. So, why now, and why is this important to you?
Well, I mean, I think that's a really good point. And Liz has mentioned for very clearly that to be able to navigate these spaces, it can be very intimidating. It can be overwhelming for many reasons. But I think that we're in a moment like no other. I don't think there'll be another time when we have such a brilliant youth constituency that is speaking on an issue that is so consequential. This is actually the 8 years, now going seven. We keep talking about it as time is passing. Mm-hmm. And we really have to make a significant shift in the way we address this issue now. And so the voices that we have got to be new, fresh, and I think nobody like the next generation to remind us that we've messed up those who have been on the forefront. You know, let's remember, for Africa at least, we're fighting a fight that was never ours to fight. This is a fight that, and that's why the justice agenda is so important. The injustice is that Africa is responsible for only 3% of global emissions. Mm-hmm. And if you remove, say, 4%, you remove South Africa, it's really 1%. And so we have a significant amount of responsibility to ensure we survive and we ensure that the next generation survives. But the real burden of responsibility on the climate issue rests on the biggest economies, the G7, really, and the G20. And so the idea of keeping the pressure on and the next generation saying that we have not caused this problem and you need to be part of the solution, those who are in the forefront, mm-hmm. to create a space where these voices are hosted, are nurtured, are especially around some very technical issues, is really powerful. I think for many of them, even just talking to youth activists, especially across this continent, many of them are looking for solidarity with each other, with others, and this is the space that will create that. You know, the Wangari Maathai Foundation was set up very deliberately on the premise of activating youth in the way that Wangari Maathai herself activated. You know, many people forget that she started the Green Belt Movement in her 30s. She wasn't that old then, and she was already doing so much that how much more can we do? And we just thought that her life could be a great example of what's possible if you put your mind to it, if you get the support that's required. And also the fact that in the very beginning, 6 or 7 years ago, Aga Khan University did a survey. They did a survey, which they called the Youth Survey, the East African Youth Survey. And that survey is the one that really inspired the thematic focus on youth for the Wangari Maathai Foundation. That survey said that, one, as you mentioned, the average age on the African continent today is 19 years old. Over 80% of Kenyans are under the age of 35. It's a very young population. This is a population that will see us through many of the commitments we're making now, 2063, 2020. So, you know, most of us will be out of the working force at that time. So this is a generation that will be responsible. But they mentioned three things that struck us. One, that young people in the East African region said that they were not willing to stand up for what they believe for fear of retribution. They also mentioned that corruption was a legitimate tool for business. And they mentioned that that a majority of them said faith in God is their biggest value. There were several contradictions in what they expressed And we thought that Wangari Maathai's life and work would be a great inspiration for them. And so the foundation itself was set up to anchor that and create a space. I'll have to say, we're very proud that the fact that the Wangari Maathai Foundation itself is run by youth, young women who are activating spaces that are excited and that excite them. So Liz is part of the foundation, and her work around climate and what she's doing with Green Generation, she brings it into the foundation, and she's able to activate her own work and find a space where she can be creative. So the hub is actually a very, very much a joint creation of these young people who have, this is what they need, and the foundation gives them a space to create it.
Oh, thank you. I think one thing that is admirable with the hub, which I am a part of as well, is that there's that freedom to be creative, to do you while you try and create change within your community. And you touched on the aspect of injustice, which is, and we will keep insisting, Africa is not part of the problem. We only contributed like 3%. So I don't think the common public understands this enough. We actually need justice, because we're already experiencing a lot of climate change impacts, and the process to try and get solutions for us, not just for us within the city, but at the grassroots level, for those farmers who can no longer plant when they're supposed to plant and keep losing their yield year after year, what kind of justice are they getting for the crops they're losing? Because this is like a source of economic development and income for them. So I think it's only important that, like have you said, with the Activist Hub, our voices are amplified, and we have an opportunity to be motivated and to be mentored through that process as well. And now that you've spoken of the late Professor Wangari Maathai, I'd want to know, so as young people, we are lucky to have platforms. I'm sure this is not how it used to be. I mean, having such an opportunity to speak openly about our experiences and our opinions, even on this podcast and the social media platforms that are open for us. What was it like as a young woman, being in that space as well, you know, in that space of climate activism and environmental activism? What was it like back in the day, and what has changed, and what do you think should be done differently for us young people, not just women, but us young people who have an opportunity to create change?
Well, you know, I think you're doing much better than we did. Mm-hmm. I think you are a lot more active, you're a lot more activated. My mother's generation was like that, and I'm to some extent, I'm not surprised. Sometimes I joke, but I think it's probably true. It skips a generation, and it sort of like moves to the next generation. Mm-hmm. But I really think that there is an opportunity, just because the space is so occupied by young people, the entrepreneurship, the energy that is being stifled by not having secure energy access, for example. Mm-hmm. The fact that for Africa, yes, it is not about mitigating against the emissions or greenhouse gases. It's about protecting ourselves and cushioning ourselves against the impacts that are coming and that are actually already here. Mm-hmm. And so that is huge. And it's about the dignity of the African people. It's about our very connection as humans. And that's what I think the youth activists today communicate so effectively, that this is not really an intellectual discussion. This is an everyday life thing. We're trying to run our businesses. We're trying to be creative, but we're stifled. We're stifled by the fact that our development agenda cannot move faster, that we actually have the energy to do that, but we cannot move faster. All of that is a function of not having access to energy, of not having the financing to activate renewable energy at the scale that we would like to see, of having, you know, too much water or too little water, so our agriculture is frustrated. Flooding is happening in ways we've never seen. If you live in KwaZulu-Natal today, can you just imagine what it means to wake up when it has rained, thinking that you'll be flooded out again? All of this, the vulnerability that we face today, is what we must really fight about. We're fighting the fight of our lives, really, because it is the fight to protect ourselves against the worst impacts of a problem we did not create. And we cannot wait. The truth is, we cannot wait for others to come in and help. We must continue to put pressure, especially on finance. Finance is the biggest opportunity. It will unlock what we need to unlock to protect ourselves. But without that, we have to build resilience in whatever way we can.
Oh, great. Quite insightful. So to Liz, as Wanjera has said, you have had the opportunity and the platform to speak for the voiceless. And so what is it like being a young African activist speaking for that person in the grassroots area who has no means of getting to COP? I mean, what is it like being in that space, having that opportunity to speak out for them?
I would like to respond to this through the voices of other African climate activists that I've heard from before, and especially during UNEA Assembly, where we had this round set up with young activists. And one of the questions we asked them was the same question: what is it like for you being a young climate activist from Africa and you have to navigate in these spaces? And some of the responses I got were responses that I would also respond at times, especially before we began to create this space for young activists to feel meaningfully and actively engaged through the hub. And we did hear responses of young activists saying things like, sometimes they feel alone, sometimes they have difficulties navigating spaces because they don't feel, you know, actively engaged, trained with the skills they need, with the resources they need to actually be on those spaces. And many times they're trying to find their voices, they're trying to get their voices heard. And these are young activists who come from a community like has least contributed to this problem. So these stories are the ones that should actually be being listened to and should be the ones that are being heard. And I think the other example I would give was in a panel that I was in Davos, and the panel did not have a young person, but the moderator is asking the people on the panel, what do you think about youth and hope? And I'm thinking to myself the whole time, there should have been a young person to respond to that question, to say, you know, what do you think about young people and hope? And again, it goes beyond even having the young people on the platforms to speak, because many times why the young people have even the rising eco-anxieties, I think the other time I was seeing some statistics from AVA saying that about 70% of young people are feeling afraid of how the future will look like because of climate change. And they're not afraid because of the science. It's because of the fact that the problem is very huge, but what's being done is not close to what science says that must be done. And so seeing young people trying to get their voices heard and the outcomes that come as a result of some of these decisions that are being made do not reflect what the young people are saying, then it's one point in which they begin to feel like they're not being listened to. Because it's one thing to be on the platforms to speak, and it's another to actually feel that you're actually being heard, someone is listening to you, and that they're doing everything that they can to make sure that your voices feed into the decision-making platforms. So I think one of the things that would make things a little bit different is for this group to continue having the support needed and to also keep building that momentum, because it's a time when I feel the African youth activist voices are rising and they're beginning to actually be more louder than before. And the fact that they're keeping up a fight, you know, you're not in the spaces, but you're still trying to figure out how to get yourself into those spaces. And you're trying to actually make sure that your voice is being heard at every level possible. And most importantly, I think that courage, just courage as leadership too, that can be molded, and we can begin to have skills and more platforms and opportunities for these young activists to keep having their voices out there, I think is what is really important. But for me, momentum is everything, because if we begin to sort of back off and things are still only getting worse, then it's going to be difficult for us to keep pushing. So the moment we get louder, the moment we get more stronger, I think that sort of group and that support and that people power around this activism is what is going to make things move. And I think we are getting there.
Yeah, I really think you're making major strides in this space. And you did mention that sometimes it feels like you're just given the space, but then are you really being heard? And, you know, the question to ask ourselves is, what is meaningful youth engagement in this space? Is it just, are they just ticking a box that, oh yeah, we have youth in the panel and that's it, but are our voices being actually heard? Are our opinions being considered? Are they being added into the spaces where decision makers are and our voices actually being considered as some of the solutions that we can provide, because we are creative people. We are doing a lot in the ground, but, you know, like you said, we are still struggling to put ourselves out there. And I do appreciate your comment about, you know, building the momentum and keep, and, you know, let's keep going as young people. Let's keep making the noise, and at some point we're going to actually create a difference. So we are moving to the last segment of this episode, and this year the COP is happening in Egypt, which is Africa, and I think we all agree that we ought to have a shared narrative of what our expectations are for COP27. When you look at COP26, there was some sort of organization, there was a COP26 coalition, and it seemed like they were very organized. So do we have that back at home, and are we actually developing a shared narrative towards COP27? What happens after COP27 is done? Are we going to get our priorities heard? Are we going to get solutions for loss and damage in Africa? Are we going to get more money for adaptation? Are we going to increase, are we going to consider communities when it comes to just energy transition? So as Wanjira, what is your expectation for this year's COP, being that it's happening in Africa and you are an African? What would you want to see?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's great that the COP is happening in Africa, and the agenda ought to focus on, in my opinion, the key issues that matter to us. One is adaptation, of course, and adaptation finance, setting the goal that we want to see. What does it look like? What is our goal that we are trying to achieve for adaptation? Yeah. You mentioned loss and damage. That is a huge and important issue for us. As Liz and others say all the time, this is an issue we're already facing. Climate change is not coming, it's here. So we absolutely have to look at the issue of loss and damage. Fortunately, we had some really good progress on at least putting this issue on the agenda. What we must at a minimum see is the activation of a finance facility for loss and damage. You know, in the Paris Agreement, it actually codes, we want to avert, minimize, and address loss and damage. We're doing a lot of talking about averting and minimizing, but we are not talking about how we are addressing. To address loss and damage is to actually finance some of the loss and damage that's going on. So we have to ensure that that pressure continues and that we get to COP27 with a very clear pathway to that finance facility or flows of finance for loss and damage. And then the other one, my other hope, I have those three dreams. So the third one is on the African just energy transition, that we really begin to appreciate the fact that for Africa, energy is not only about reducing emissions, it's about development. Africa's development agenda is going to be the most important element of building resilience. You cannot adapt when you are at the level of poverty that we see on this continent. It is practically impossible. When the sixth assessment report came out, Working Group 3, one of the things that was said is that most vulnerable countries are 15 times more vulnerable than others. And that's problematic. If you're trying to adapt and you live in Kenya or Bangladesh or any of the countries that are prone, you will be 15 times less likely to manage. And what that really means is that even with a country like the Netherlands, which is below and more people are exposed to sea level rise in a country like that than they are in Bangladesh, people in Bangladesh will suffer more loss and damage. That ought to be considered. We have to lift the quality of life of our people if they're going to manage to adapt against climate change. So for us, the energy transition is a fundamental must-have. We have to get energy access up, and we have to get energy for industry and for development up.
So that is just transition, loss and damage, and adaptation. Mm. And when it comes to energy, you have specified it's not just for electrification. Let's think about access for Africa. Let's think about the development when it comes to energy and its usage and its productive use.
Absolutely. So, and maybe I should also just add that finance for all of that is what's important. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of discussion about the fact that, you know, which way should Africa go? And there's a lot of unhelpful discussions around gas or no gas. That's not really the question. The issue is, Of course, we all want to move, and we must, to a net zero pathway that is largely renewable. That's what we must all endeavor to do. Mm-hmm. But it requires a significant amount of finance. And that finance, therefore, must be at the top of the agenda. And the other piece I must say is we must have ratcheted up ambition from the biggest emitters. We will not make and we will not crack this problem if we continue to have the largest emitters continuing to emit at the levels they are.
Mm-hmm. And on energy, luckily for Africa, we have an opportunity to leapfrog. But for us to get there, like you said, finance is a key recipe for us to get to a place of just energy transition. And yeah, thank you so much for that. Mm-hmm. And now to Liz, I know in your activism, from what I have picked, watching your videos and just interacting with you, I know you are trying your best to humanize the climate crisis. And I know most people, even these big emitters and fossil fuel companies, they try to detach themselves from the human connection when it comes to climate change, I think to evade guilt. And so while we move to COP27, you made a really moving speech at COP26. I remember I was seated watching you in some charging pot at COP, and I was moved. So I don't understand anyone else who was not moved by that speech, because you're honestly just evading your consciousness. So tell us, what is your expectation for COP27 this year? Are you still pushing for the humanizing of the climate crisis, or are we talking about something different this time?
You know, I always say, when we look at the bigger picture around all this, these are human problems. And for us to solve human problems, we will need a human heart and a human mind as well, to think about the people whose lives and livelihoods are impacted by the decisions that are being made today. And right now, if we look around what's happening, the humanitarian crisis that I described still back then is worsening. And again, when you hear from what the leaders are saying, is the fact that things are going to get better, it's all going to be all right. But our response is the fact that we cannot be convinced or have the trust that it's all going to be all right if the steps, the clear and concrete steps that are needed to make things all right, are not being done right now. And so for me, the biggest thing about COP27, it's great that I share most of the expectations, as Wanjera mentioned as well. And so I'm just going to add on to that and say that I think COP27 should be about accountability and delivery, because this is another COP after another COP. COP26. And so we cannot still say that we have been here before with pledges being made and they're not being met. So this has to be about delivering, about accountability, because we're not creating anything new. Almost all these things leaders have pledged to, they've committed to before. But why we are not getting there is because we are not still thinking about the people who need immediate action. Most of the things that we get is about thinking into the 20 years to come, next years to come. But the people that I talk about every day are not going to benefit from an outcome that is going to only really start operating in 20 years to come. And I think the most challenging thing about the outcomes that we get is that most of them don't have clear pathways of how we will get there. And leaders talk about, for example, ending deforestation by 2030, but what's the pathway? We cannot just sit down and wake up to a deforestation-free world in 2030 if the steps are not being taken right now. So it's going to be about delivery, about accountability, and about immediate action right now. And also, most importantly, in addition to what Wanjera mentioned about a separate facility for loss and damage, we should also have a COP that also really looks at nature as a piece. Africa is one of the continents that still has most of its resources intact, but even those are threatened, and the world does not talk about it as much as they talk about other ecosystems around the world, for instance. And so if we can have this nature piece as well as a priority at the COP, and the fact that we need to recognize that we have an economic system or model that has seen nature being destroyed faster than it can even regenerate itself. So we cannot make decisions that still continue to destroy our ecosystems. It's about restoration, it's about regenerating, but it's also about protecting what we already have intact right now. And most importantly, I think, yes, it's about time that leaders actually delivered their promises. We have so many promises on climate finance, some as old as the 2009 promise that has not been met, but still we
cannot move forward if all we get is the pledges and commitments that are not being met. So we need to make sure that these voices, the young voices from Africa, people who are speaking of the urgency, are actually loud and very much included at the COP. And then the other thing is that many people are talking about COP being an African COP. My definition of an African COP is not COP coming to African soil. It's about an African COP that is in Africa, but also the outcome supports and has priority of the present needs of the African continent. So we cannot conclude after Shamal Sheikh said that it was an African COP if there was no African representation and if the outcome did not feed into the present needs of the African continent. So I think we would really need to make sure that we also push on that to actually make this COP27 work for Africa.
Wow, that's a beautiful definition. I mean, we cannot say we had an African COP if our priorities as Africans are not looked into or are not acted upon. So before I wrap up, I don't know if any of you had something to say before I wrap up.
We've said everything, haven't we?
Okay, great. So this was a really wonderful session. You're two inspirational women, and keep doing the great job. And to Wanjira, thank you for being such a mentor to young people.
We
look up to you. Thank you for the support. It's not just that you're up there and you're not doing nothing about it, but you're actually holding our hands, and we really, really appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much.
To Liz, keep the fire burning. We're behind you. And, you know, keep inspiring young people to be the best version of themselves as they try to advocate for justice for communities that are at the forefront of climate change. Thank you so much. This was Hardly Hewa Podcast, episode 1, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Thank you.